When Mr. Hopkins saw the Ichabod, he fell to his knees in shock, while Hetty simply stood there with her mouth hanging open. When the strange party came close enough and the husband and wife were able to read all the signs, they thought they must have gone mad. Daisy, who'd expected people to react like this, called down to them, "You aren't dreaming. This is the Ichabod, and it's kind and peaceful. It's never killed anyone. In fact, it saved our lives." The Ichabod bent down carefully so that it wouldn't dislodge Daisy and patted the thin sheep on the head. Instead of running away, it baaed, quite unafraid, then returned to eating the thin, dry grass. "You see," said Daisy, "your sheep knows it's harmless. Come with us. You can ride on our wagon." The Hopkinses were so tired and hungry that, even though they were still very scared of the Ichabod, they heaved themselves up beside Martha, bringing their sheep too. Then off trundled the Ichabod, the six humans, and the sheep, heading for Jeroboam. Chapter 59. Back to Jeroboam. Dusk was falling as the dark grey outline of Jeroboam came into view. The Ichabod's party made a brief stop on a hill overlooking the city. Martha handed the Ichabod the big bunch of snowdrops. Then everyone made sure they were holding their signs the right way up, and the four friends shook hands, because they'd sworn to each other and to the Ichabod that they would protect it and never stand aside, even if people threatened them with guns. So, down the hill towards the winemaking city, the Ichabod marched, and the guards at the city gates saw it coming. They raised their guns to fire. But Daisy stood up on the Ichabod's shoulder, waving her arms, and Bert and Roderick held their signs aloft. Rifles shaking, the guards watched fearfully as the monster walked closer and closer. "The Ichabod has never killed anyone," shouted Daisy. "You've been told lies," shouted Bert. The guards didn't know what to do because they didn't want to shoot the four young people. The Ichabod shuffled ever closer, and its size and strangeness were both terrifying. But it had a kindly look in its enormous eyes and was holding snowdrops in its paw. At last, reaching the guards, the Ichabod came to a halt, bent down, and offered each of them a snowdrop. The guards took the flowers because they were afraid not to. Then the Ichabod patted each of them gently on the head, as it had done to the sheep, and walked on into Jeroboam. There were screams on every side. People fled before the Ichabod or dived to find weapons, but Bert and Roderick marched resolutely in front of it, holding up their signs, and the Ichabod continued offering snowdrops to passers-by, until at last a young woman bravely took one. The Ichabod was so delighted, it thanked her in its booming voice, which made more people scream. But others edged closer to the Ichabod, and soon a little crowd of people was clustered around the monster, taking snowdrops from its paw and laughing. And the Ichabod was starting to smile too. It had never expected to be cheered or thanked by people. "I told you they'd love you if they knew you," Daisy whispered in the Ichabod's ear. "Come with us," shouted Bert at the crowd. "We're marching south to see the king." And now the Jeroboamers, who had suffered so much under Spittleworth's rule, ran back to their houses to fetch torches, pitchforks, and guns, not to harm the Ichabod, but to protect it. Furious at the lies they'd been told, they clustered around the monster and off they marched through the gathering darkness, with only one short detour. Daisy insisted on stopping at the orphanage. Though the door was, of course, firmly locked and bolted, a kick from the Ichabod soon put that right. The Ichabod helped Daisy gently down, and she ran inside to fetch all the children. The little ones scrambled up into the wagon, the Hopkins twins fell into the arms of their parents, and the larger children joined the crowd, while Ma Grunter screamed and stormed and tried to call them back. Then she saw the Ichabod's huge, hairy face squinting at her through a window, and I'm happy to tell you she passed out cold on the floor. Then the delighted Ichabod continued down the main street of Jeroboam, collecting more and more people as it went, and nobody noticed Basher John watching from a corner as the crowd passed. Basher John, who'd been drinking in a local tavern, hadn't forgotten the bloody nose he'd received from Roderick Roach on the night the two boys stole his keys. He realized at once that if these troublemakers, with their overgrown marsh monster, reached the capital, anybody who'd made pots of gold from the myth of the dangerous Ichabod would be in trouble. So instead of returning to the orphanage, Basher John stole another drinker's horse from outside the tavern. Unlike the Ichabod, which was moving slowly, Basher John was soon galloping south to warn Lord Spittleworth of the danger marching on Shoeville. Chapter 60. Rebellion. Sometimes, I don't know how, people who live many miles apart seem to realize the time has come to act. Perhaps ideas can spread like pollen on the breeze. In any case, down in the palace dungeon, the prisoners, who'd hidden knives and chisels, heavy saucepans and rolling pins beneath their mattresses, and stones in their cell walls, were ready at last. At dawn, on the day the Ichabod approached Kurdsburg, Captain Goodfellow and Mr. Dovetail, whose cells were opposite each other, were awake, pale, tense, and sitting on the edges of their beds, because today was the day they'd vowed to escape or die. Several floors above the prisoners, Lord Spittleworth, too, woke early. Completely unaware that a prison breakout was brewing beneath his feet, or that a real live Ichabod was at that very moment advancing on Shoeville, surrounded by an ever-growing crowd of cornucopians, Spittleworth washed, dressed in his chief advisor's robes, then headed out to a locked wing of the stables, which had been under guard for a week. "Stand aside," Spittleworth told the soldiers on guard, and he unbolted the doors. A team of exhausted seamstresses and tailors were waiting beside the model of a monster inside the stable. It was the size of a bull, with leathery skin, and was covered in spikes. Its carved feet bore fearsome claws, its mouth was full of fangs, and its angry eyes glowed amber in its face. The seamstresses and tailors watched fearfully as Spittleworth walked slowly around their creation. Close up, you could see the stitching, tell that the eyes were made of glass, that the spikes were really nails pushed through the leather, and that the claws and fangs were nothing but painted wood. If you prodded the beast, a trickle of sawdust ran from the seams. Nevertheless, by the dim light of the stables, it was a convincing piece of work, and the seamstresses and tailors were thankful to see Spittleworth smile. "It will do, by candlelight at least," he said. "I'll simply have to make the dear king stand well back as he looks at it. We can say the spikes and fangs are still poisonous." The workers exchanged relieved looks. They'd been working all day and all night for a week. Now, at last, they'd be able to go home to their families. "Soldiers," said Spittleworth, turning to the guards waiting in the courtyard, "take these people away. If you scream," he added lazily, as the youngest seamstress opened her mouth to do so, "you'll be shot." While the team that had made the stuffed Ichabod was dragged away by the soldiers, Spittleworth went upstairs, whistling, to the king's apartments, where he found Fred wearing silk pyjamas and a hairnet over his moustaches, and Flapoon tucking a napkin beneath his many chins. "Good morning, Your Majesty," said Spittleworth with a bow. "I trust you slept well. I have a surprise for Your Majesty today. We have succeeded in having one of the Ichabogs stuffed. I know Your Majesty was eager to see it." "Wonderful, Spittleworth," said the king. "And after that, we might send it around the kingdom, what? To show the people what we're up against." "I would advise against that, sire," said Spittleworth, who feared that if anybody saw the stuffed Ichabod by daylight, they'd be sure to spot it as a fake. "We wouldn't want the common folk to panic. Your Majesty is so brave that you can cope with the sight." But before Spittleworth could finish, the doors to the king's private apartments flew open, and in ran a wild-eyed, sweaty Basher John, who'd been delayed on the road by not one, but two sets of highwaymen. After getting lost in some woods and falling off his horse while jumping a ditch, then being unable to catch it again, Basher John hadn't managed to reach the palace much ahead of the Ichabod. Panicking, he'd forced entry to the palace through a scullery window, and two guards had pursued him through the palace, both of them prepared to run him through with their swords. Fred let out a scream and hid behind Flapoon. Spittleworth pulled out his dagger and jumped to his feet.
"There's an Ichabod,"
panted Basher John, falling to his knees.
"A real life Ichabod is coming here with thousands of people. The Ichabod is real."
Naturally, Spittleworth didn't believe this story for a second.
"Take him to the dungeons,"
he snarled at the guards, who dragged the struggling Basher John from the room and closed the doors again. "I do apologize, sire," said Spittleworth, who was still holding his dagger. "The man will be horsewhipped, and so will the guards who let him break into the pa-" But before Spittleworth could finish his sentence, two more men came bursting into the king's private apartments. These were Spittleworth's Shoeville spies, who'd had word from the north about the Ichabod's approach, but as the king had never laid eyes on them before, he let out another terrified squeal.
"My lord," panted the first spy, bowing to Spittleworth, "there's an Ichabod coming this way."
"And it's got a crowd with it," panted the second. "It's real."
"Well, of course the Ichabod's real," said Spittleworth, who could hardly say anything else with the king present.
"Notify the Ichabod Defence Brigade. I shall join them shortly in the courtyard, and we'll kill the beast."
Spittleworth ushered the spies to the door and thrust them back into the passageway, trying to drown out their whispers of,
"My lord, it's real, and the people like it,"
and,
"I saw it, my lord, with my own two eyes."
We shall kill this monster as we've killed all the others,"
said Spittleworth loudly for the king's benefit. And then, under his breath, he added,
"Go away."
Spittleworth closed the door firmly on the spies and returned to the table, disturbed but trying not to show it. Flapoon was still tucking into some Baronstown ham. He had a vague idea that Spittleworth must be behind all these people rushing in and talking about live Ichabogs, so he wasn't frightened in the slightest. Fred, on the other hand, was quivering from head
to foot. "Imagine the monster showing itself in daylight, Spittleworth," he whimpered. "I thought it only ever came out at night."
"Yes, it's getting far too bold, isn't it, Your Majesty?" said Spittleworth. He had no idea what this so-called real Ichabod could be. The only thing he could imagine was that some common folk had rigged up some kind of fake monster, possibly to steal food or force gold out of their neighbours. But it would still have to be stopped, of course. There was only one true Ichabod, and that was the one Spittleworth had invented. "Come, Flapoon, we must prevent this beast from entering Shoeville."
"You're so brave, Spittleworth," said King Fred in a broken voice.
"Tish, pish, Your Majesty," said Spittleworth. "I would lay down my life for Cornucopia. You should know that by now."
Spittleworth's hand was on the door handle when yet more running footsteps, this time accompanied by shouting and clanging, shattered the peace. Startled, Spittleworth opened the door to see what was going on. A group of ragged prisoners was running towards him. At the head of them was the white-haired Mr. Dovetail, who held an axe, and burly Captain Goodfellow, who carried a gun, clearly wrestled from the hands of a palace guard. Right behind them came Mrs. Beamish, her hair flying behind her as she brandished an enormous saucepan. And hot on her heels came Millicent, Lady Eslander's maid, who held a rolling pin. Just in time, Spittleworth slammed and bolted the door. Within seconds, Mr. Dovetail's axe had smashed through the wood. "Flapoon, come!" shouted Spittleworth, and the two lords ran across the room to another door, which led to a staircase down to the courtyard. Fred, who had no idea what was going on, who'd never even realized that there were 50 people trapped in the dungeon of his palace, was slow to react. Seeing the faces of the furious prisoners appear at the hole Mr. Dovetail had hacked in the door, he jumped up to follow the two lords, but they, interested only in their own skins, had bolted it from the other side. King Fred was left standing in his pyjamas with his back to the wall, watching the escaped prisoners hack their way into his room. Chapter 61. Flapoon Fires Again. The two lords dashed out into the palace courtyard to find the Ichabod Defence Brigade already mounted and armed, as Spittleworth had ordered. However, Major Prod, the man who'd kidnapped Daisy years before, who'd been promoted after Spittleworth shot Major Roach, was looking nervous.
"My lord," he said to Spittleworth, who was hastily mounting his horse, "there's something happening inside the palace. We heard an uproar."
"Never mind that now," snapped Spittleworth.
A sound of shattering glass made all the soldiers look up.
"There are people in the king's bedroom," cried Prod. "Shouldn't we help him?"
"Forget the king," shouted Spittleworth.
Captain Goodfellow now appeared at the king's bedroom window. Looking down, he bellowed,
"You won't escape, Spittleworth."
"Oh, won't I?" snarled the lord, and kicking his thin yellow horse, he forced it into a gallop and disappeared out of the palace gates.
Major Prod was too scared of Spittleworth not to follow, so he and the rest of the Ichabod Defence Brigade charged after his lordship. Along with Flapoon, who'd barely managed to get onto his horse before Spittleworth set off, bouncing along at the rear, holding on to his horse's mane for dear life and trying to find his stirrups.
Some men might have considered themselves beaten, what with escaped prisoners taking over the palace and a fake Ichabod marching through the country and attracting crowds, but not Lord Spittleworth. He still had a squad of well-trained, well-armed soldiers riding behind him, heaps of gold
hidden at his mansion in the country, and his crafty brain was already devising a plan. Firstly, he'd shoot the men who'd faked this Ichabod and terrify the people back into obedience. Then he'd send Major Prod and his soldiers back to the palace to kill all the escaped prisoners. Of course, the prisoners might have killed the king by that time, but in truth, it might be easier to govern the country without Fred. As he galloped along, Spittleworth thought bitterly that if only he hadn't had to put so much effort into lying to the king, he might not have made certain mistakes, like letting that wretched pastry chef have knives and saucepans. He also regretted not hiring more spies, because then he might have found out that someone was making a fake Ichabod, a fake, by the sound of it, that was far more convincing than the one he had seen that morning in the stables. So the Ichabod Defence Brigade charged through the surprisingly empty cobbled streets of Shoeville and out onto the open road that led to Curdsburg. To Spittleworth's fury, he now saw why the Shoeville streets had been empty. Having heard the rumour that an actual Ichabod was walking towards the capital with a large crowd, the citizens of Shoeville had hurried out to catch a glimpse of it with their own eyes.
"Out of our way! Out of our way!"
screamed Spittleworth, scattering the common people before him, furious to see them looking excited rather than scared. He spurred his horse onwards until its sides were bleeding, and Lord Flapoon followed, now green in the face, because he hadn't had time to digest his breakfast. At last, Spittleworth and the soldiers spotted the huge crowd advancing in the distance, and Spittleworth hauled at his poor horse's reins so that it skidded to a halt in the road. There, in the midst of the thousands of laughing and singing cornucopians, was a giant creature as tall as two horses, with eyes glowing like lamps, covered in long, greenish-brown hair like marsh weed. On its shoulder rode a young woman, and in front of it marched two young men holding up wooden signs. Every now and then, the monster stooped down and, yes, it seemed to be handing out flowers. "It's a trick," muttered Spittleworth, so shocked and scared he hardly knew what he was saying.
"It must be a trick," he said more loudly, craning his scrawny neck to try and see how it was done. "There are obviously people standing on each other's shoulders inside a suit of marshweed. Guns at the ready, men."
But the soldiers were slow to obey. In all the time they'd been supposedly protecting the country from the Ichabod, the soldiers had never seen one, nor had they really expected to, yet they weren't at all convinced they were watching a trick. On the contrary, the creature looked very real to them. It was patting dogs on the head and handing out flowers to children and letting that girl sit on its shoulder. It didn't seem fierce at all. The soldiers were also scared of the crowd of thousands marching along with the Ichabod, who all seemed to like it. What would they do if the Ichabod was attacked? Then one of the youngest soldiers lost his head completely.
"That's not a trick! I'm off!"
Before anybody could stop him, he'd galloped away. Flapoon, who had at last found his stirrups, now rode up front to take his place beside Spittleworth.
"What do we do?" asked Flapoon, watching the Ichabod and the joyful singing crowd drawing nearer and nearer.
"I'm thinking," snarled Spittleworth. "I'm thinking."
But the cogs of Spittleworth's busy brain seemed to have jammed at last. It was the joyful faces that upset him most. He had come to think of laughter as a luxury, like Shoeville pastries and silk sheets, and seeing these ragged people having fun frightened him more than if they'd all been carrying guns.
"I'll shoot it," said Flapoon, raising his gun and taking aim at the Ichabog.
"No," said Spittleworth. "Look, man, can't you see we're outnumbered?"
But at that precise moment, the Ichabog let out a deafening, blood-curdling scream. The crowd that had pressed around it backed away, their faces suddenly scared. Many dropped their flowers, some broke into a run. With another terrible screech, the Ichabog fell to its knees, almost shaking Daisy loose, though she clung on tightly. And then a huge dark split appeared down the Ichabog's enormous, swollen belly.
"You were right, Spittleworth,"
bellowed Flapoon, raising his blunderbuss.
"There are men hiding inside it."
And as people in the crowd began to scream and flee, Lord Flapoon took aim at the Ichabog's belly and fired. Chapter 62. The Bonding. And now, several things happened at almost the same time, so nobody watching could possibly keep up. But luckily, I can tell you about all of them. Lord Flapoon's bullet went flying towards the Ichabog's opening belly. Both Bert and Roderick, who'd sworn to protect the Ichabog no matter what, flung themselves into the path of that bullet, which hit Bert squarely in the chest, and as he fell to the ground, his wooden sign bearing the message, "The Ichabog is harmless," shattered into splinters. Then a baby Ichabog, which was already taller than a horse, came struggling out of its Ichor's belly. Its bonding had been a dreadful one, because it had come into the world full of its parents' fear of the gun, and the first thing it had ever seen was an attempt to kill it. So it sprinted straight at Flapoon, who was trying to reload. The soldiers who might have helped Flapoon were so terrified of the new monster bearing down upon them that they galloped out of its path without even trying to fire. Spittleworth was one of those who rode away fastest, and he was soon lost to sight. The baby Ichabog let out a terrible roar that still haunts the nightmares of those who witnessed the scene before launching itself at Flapoon. Within seconds, Flapoon lay dead upon the ground. All of this had happened very fast. People were screaming and crying, and Daisy was still holding on to the dying Ichabog, which lay in the road beside Bert. Roderick and Martha were bending over Bert, who, to their amazement, had opened his eyes. I think I'm all right," he whispered, and feeling beneath his shirt, he pulled out his father's huge silver medal. Flapoon's bullet was buried in it. The medal had saved Bert's life. Seeing that Bert was alive, Daisy now buried her hands in the hair on either side of the Ichabog's face again.
"I didn't see my Ichabogle,"
whispered the dying Ichabog, in whose eyes there were again tears like glass apples.
"It's beautiful,"
said Daisy, who was also starting to cry.
"Look, here."
A second Ichabogle was wriggling out of the Ichabog's tummy. This one had a friendly face and wore a timid smile, because its bonding had happened as its parent was looking into Daisy's face and had seen her tears and understood that a human could love an Ichabog as though it was one of their own family. Ignoring the noise and clamour all around it, the second Ichabogle knelt beside Daisy in the road
and stroked the big Ichabog's face. Ica and Ichaboggle looked at each other and smiled. And then the big Ichabog's eyes gently closed, and Daisy knew that it was dead. She buried her face in its shaggy hair and sobbed.
"You mustn't be sad," said a familiar, booming voice as something stroked her hair. "Don't cry, Daisy. This is the Bornding. It is a glorious thing."
Blinking, Daisy looked up at the baby, which was speaking with exactly the voice of its Ica.
"You know my name," she said.
"Well, of course I do," said the Ichaboggle kindly. "I was Bornded knowing all about you. And now we must find my Ichabob," which, Daisy understood, was what Ichabogs called their siblings.
Daisy stood up and saw Flapoon lying dead in the road and the firstborn Ichaboggle surrounded by people holding pitchforks and guns. "Climb up here with me," said Daisy urgently to the second baby, and hand in hand the two of them mounted the wagon. Daisy shouted at the crowd to listen. As she was the girl who had ridden through the country on the shoulder of the Ichabog, the nearest people guessed that she might know things worth hearing, so they shushed everyone else, and at last Daisy was able to speak.
"You mustn't hurt the Ichabogs,"
were the first words out of her mouth when at last the crowd was silent.
"If you're cruel to them, they'll have babies who are born even crueler."
"Bornded cruel," corrected the Ichaboggle beside her.
"Bornded cruel, yes," said Daisy. "But if they're bornded in kindness, they will be kind. They eat only mushrooms and they want to be our friends."
The crowd muttered uncertain until Daisy explained about Major Beamish's death on the marsh, how he'd been shot by Lord Flapoon, not killed by an Ichabog, and that Spittleworth had used the death to invent a story of a murderous monster on the marsh. Then the crowd decided that they wanted to go and talk to King Fred. So the bodies of the dead Ichabog and Lord Flapoon were loaded onto the wagon, and 20 strong men pulled it along. Then the whole procession set off for the palace, with Daisy, Martha, and the kind Ichaboggle arm in arm at the front, and 30 citizens with guns surrounding the fierce, firstborn Ichaboggle, which otherwise would have killed more humans, because it had been bornded, fearing and hating them. But after a quick discussion, Bert and Roderick vanished, and where they went, you'll find out soon. Chapter 63 Lord Spittleworth's Last Plan. When Daisy entered the palace courtyard at the head of the people's procession, she was amazed to see how little it had altered. Fountain still played, and peacock still strutted, and the only change to the front of the palace was a single broken window up on the second floor. Then the great golden doors were flung open, and the crowd saw two ragged people walking out to meet them, a white-haired man holding an axe, and a woman clutching an enormous saucepan. And Daisy, staring at the white-haired man, felt her knees buckle, and the kind Ichaboggle caught her and held her up. Mr. Dovetail tottered forward, and I don't think he even noticed that an actual live Ichabog was standing beside his long-lost daughter. As the two of them hugged and sobbed, Daisy spotted Mrs. Beamish over her father's shoulder.
"Bert's alive," she called to the pastry chef, who was looking frantically for her son. "But he had something to do. He'll be back soon."
More prisoners now came hurrying out of the palace, and there were screams of joy as loved ones found loved ones, and many of the orphanage children found the parents they'd thought were dead. Then a lot of other things happened, like the 30 strong men who surrounded the fierce Ichabogle, dragging it away before it could kill anyone else, and Daisy asking Mr. Dovetail if Martha could come and live with them, and Captain Goodfellow appearing on a balcony with a weeping King Fred, who was still wearing his pyjamas, and the crowd cheering when Captain Goodfellow said he thought it was time to try life without a king. However, we must now leave this happy scene and track down the man who was most to blame for the terrible things that had happened to Cornucopia. Lord Spittleworth was miles away, galloping down a deserted country road, when his horse suddenly went lame. When Spittleworth tried to force it onwards, the poor horse, which had had quite enough of being mistreated, reared and deposited Spittleworth onto the ground. When Spittleworth tried to whip it, the horse kicked him, then trotted away into a forest where, I am pleased to tell you, it was later found by a kind farmer who nursed it back to health. Lord Spittleworth was therefore left to jog alone down the country lanes towards his country estate, holding up his chief adviser's robes lest he trip over them, and looking over his shoulder every few yards for fear that he was being followed. He knew perfectly well that his life in Cornucopia was over, but he still had that mountain of gold hidden in his wine cellar, and he intended to load up his carriage with as many ducats as would fit, then sneak over the border into Pluritania. Night had fallen by the time Spittleworth reached his mansion, and his feet were terribly sore. Hobbling inside, he bellowed for his butler, Scrumble, who so long ago had pretended to be Nobby Button's mother and Professor Fraudisham.
"Down here, my lord," called a voice from the cellar. "Why haven't you lit the lamp, Scrumble?"
bellowed Spittleworth, feeling his way downstairs.
"Thought it best not to look like anyone was home, sir," called Scrumble.
"Ah," said Spittleworth, wincing as he limped downstairs. "So you've heard, have you?"
"Yes, sir," said the echoing voice. "I imagined you'd be wanting to clear out, my lord."
"Yes, Scrumble," said Lord Spittleworth, limping towards the distant light of a single candle. "I most certainly do." He pushed open the door to the cellar where he'd been storing his gold all these years. The butler, whom Spittleworth could only make out dimly in the candlelight, was once again wearing Professor Fraudisham's costume, the white wig and the thick glasses that shrank his eyes to almost nothing.
"Thought it best if we travel in disguise, sir," said Scrumble, holding up old Widow Buttons's black dress and ginger wig.
"Good idea," said Spittleworth, hastily pulling off his robes and pulling on the costume. "Do you have a cold, Scrumble? Your voice sounds strange."
"It's just the dust down here, sir," said the butler, moving further from the candlelight. "And what will your lordship be wanting to do with Lady Eslander? She's still locked in the library."
"Leave her," said Spittleworth, after a moment's consideration, "and serve her right for not marrying me when she had the chance."
"Very good, my lord. I've loaded up the carriage and a couple of horses with most of the gold. Perhaps your lordship could help carry this last trunk."
"I hope you weren't thinking of leaving without me, Scrumble," said Spittleworth suspiciously, wondering whether, if he'd arrived 10 minutes later, he might have found Scrumble gone.
Oh, no, my lord, Scrumble assured him. I wouldn't dream of leaving without your lordship. Withers the groom will be driving us, sir. He's ready and waiting in the courtyard.
Excellent, said Spittleworth, and together they heaved the last trunk of gold upstairs, through the deserted house, and out into the courtyard behind, where Spittleworth's carriage stood waiting in the darkness. Even the horses had sacks of gold slung over their backs. More gold had been strapped onto the top of the carriage in cases. As he and Scrumble heaved the last trunk onto the roof, Spittleworth said, "What is that peculiar noise?"
"I hear nothing, my lord," said Scrumble.
"It's an odd sort of grunting," said Spittleworth. A memory came back to Spittleworth as he stood here in the dark. That of standing in the icy white fog on the marsh all those years before, and the whimpers of the dog struggling against the brambles in which it was tangled. This was a similar noise, as though some creature were trapped and unable to free itself, and it made Lord Spittleworth quite as nervous as it had last time, when, of course, it had been followed by Flapoon firing his blunderbuss and starting both of them onto the path to riches, and the country down the road to ruin.
Scrumble, I don't like that noise.
I don't expect you do, my lord. The moon slid out from behind a cloud, and Lord Spittleworth, turning quickly towards his butler, whose voice sounded very different all of a sudden, found himself staring down the barrel of one of his own guns. Scrumble had removed Professor Frodisham's wig and glasses to reveal that he wasn't the butler at all, but Bert Beamish. And for just a moment, seen by moonlight, the boy looked so like his father that Spittleworth had the crazy notion that Major Beamish had risen from the dead to punish him. Then he looked wildly around him and saw, through the open door of the carriage, the real Scrumble, gagged and tied up on the floor, which was where the odd whimpering was coming from, and Lady Eslander sitting there, smiling and holding a second gun. Opening his mouth to ask Withers the groom why he didn't do something, Spittleworth realized that this wasn't Withers, but Roderick Roach. When he had spotted the two boys galloping up the drive, the real groom had quite rightly sensed trouble, and stealing his favourite of Lord Spittleworth's horses, had ridden off into the night.
"How did you get here so fast?" was all Spittleworth could think to say.
"We borrowed some horses from a farmer," said Bert. In fact, Bert and Roderick were much better riders than Spittleworth, so their horses hadn't gone lame. They'd managed to overtake him and had arrived in plenty of time to free Lady Eslander, find out where the gold was, tie up Scrumble the butler, and force him to tell them the full story of how Spittleworth had fooled the country, including his own impersonation of Professor Frodisham and Widow Buttons.
"Boys, let's not be hasty," said Spittleworth faintly. "There's a lot of gold here. I'll share it with you."
"It isn't yours to share," said Bert. "You're coming back to Shoeville, and we're going to have a proper trial." Chapter 64. Cornucopia Again. Once upon a time, there was a tiny country called Cornucopia, which was ruled by a team of newly appointed advisers and a prime minister, who, at the time of which I write, was called Gordon Goodfellow. Prime Minister Goodfellow had been elected by the people of Cornucopia because he was a very honest man, and Cornucopia was a country that had learned the value of truth. There was a countrywide celebration when Prime Minister Goodfellow announced
that he was going to marry Lady Eslanda, the kind and brave woman who'd given important evidence against Lord Spittleworth. The king, who'd allowed his happy little kingdom to be driven to ruin and despair, stood trial, along with the chief adviser and a number of other people who'd benefited from Spittleworth's lies, including Mar Grunter, Basher John, Cankerby the footman, and Otto Scrumble. The king simply wept all through his questioning, but Lord Spittleworth answered in a cold, proud voice, and told so many lies and tried to blame so many other people for his own wickedness that he made matters far worse for himself than if he had simply sobbed like Fred. Both men were imprisoned in the dungeons beneath the palace with all the other criminals. I quite understand, by the way, if you wish Bert and Roderick had shot Spittleworth. After all, he had caused hundreds of other people's deaths. However, it should comfort you to know that Spittleworth really would have preferred to be dead than to sit in the dungeon all day and night, where he ate plain food and slept between rough sheets and had to listen for hours on end to Fred crying. The gold that Spittleworth and Flapoon had stolen was recovered, so that all those people who'd lost their cheese shops and their bakeries, their dairies and their pig farms, their butchers' shops and their vineyards could start them back up again and begin producing the famous cornucopian food and wine once more. However, during the long period of cornucopia's poverty, many had lost the opportunity to learn how to make cheese, sausages, wine and pastries. Some of them became librarians, because Lady Eslanda had the excellent idea of turning all the now useless orphanages into libraries, which she helped stock. However, that still left a lot of people without jobs. And that is how the fifth great city of Cornucopia came into being. Its name was Ickerby, and it lay between Curdsburg and Jeroboam on the banks of the River Fluma. When the second-born Ickerboggle heard of the problem of people who had never learned a trade, it suggested timidly that it might teach them how to farm mushrooms, which was something it understood very well. So successful did the mushroom growers become that a prosperous town sprang up around them. You might think you don't like mushrooms, but I promise, if you tasted the creamy mushroom soups of Ickerby, you'd love them for the rest of your life. Curdsburg and Baronstown developed new recipes that included Ickerby mushrooms. In fact, shortly before Prime Minister Goodfellow married Lady Eslanda, the King of Pluritania offered Goodfellow the choice of any of his daughter's hands for a year's supply of cornucopian pork and mushroom sausages. Prime Minister Goodfellow sent the sausages as a gift, along with an invitation to the Goodfellow's wedding. And Lady Eslanda added a note suggesting that King Porfirio might want to stop offering people his daughters in exchange for food and let them choose their own husbands. Ickerby was an unusual city, though, because unlike Shoeville, Curdsburg, Baronstown and Jeroboam, it was famous for three products instead of one. Firstly, there were the mushrooms, every single one of them as beautiful as a pearl. Secondly, there were the glorious silver salmon and trout, which fishermen caught in the River Fluma. And you might like to know that a statue of the old lady who studied the fish of the Fluma stood proudly in one of Ickerby's squares. Thirdly, Ickerby produced wool. You see, it was decided by Prime Minister Goodfellow that the few marshlanders who'd survived the long period of hunger deserved better pastures for their sheep than could be found in the north. Well, when the marshlanders were given a few lush fields on the bank of the Fluma,
they showed what they could really do. The wool of Cornucopia was the softest, silkiest wool in the world, and the sweaters and socks and scarves it produced were more beautiful and comfortable than could be found anywhere else. The sheep farm of Hetty Hopkins and her family produced excellent wool. But I'd have to say that the finest garments of all were spun from the wool of Roderick and Martha Roach, who had a thriving farm just outside Ickerby. Yes, Roderick and Martha got married, and I'm pleased to say they were very happy, had 5 children, and that Roderick began to speak with a slight Marshlander accent. 2 other people got married as well. I'm delighted to tell you that on leaving the dungeon, and though no longer forced to live next to each other, those old friends, Mrs. Beamish and Mr. Dovetail, found that they couldn't do without each other. So, with Bert as best man and Daisy as chief bridesmaid, the carpenter and the pastry chef were married, and Bert and Daisy, who'd felt like brother and sister for so long, now truly were. Mrs. Beamish opened her own splendid pastry shop in the heart of Shoeville, where, in addition to fairies' cradles, maidens' dreams, duke's delights, folderol fancies, and hopes of heaven, she produced Ickerpuffs, which were the lightest, fluffiest pastries you could possibly imagine, all covered with a delicate dusting of peppermint chocolate shavings, which gave them the appearance of being covered in marshweed. Bert followed in his father's footsteps and joined the Cornucopian army. A just and brave man, I wouldn't be at all surprised if he ends up at the head of it. Daisy became the world's foremost authority on Ickerbogs. She wrote many books about their fascinating behaviour, and it is due to Daisy that Ickerbogs became protected and beloved by the people of Cornucopia. In her free time, she ran a successful carpentry business with her father, and one of their most popular products were toy Ickerbogs. The second-born Ickerboggle lived in what was once the King's Deer Park, close to Daisy's workshop, and the two remained very good friends. There was a museum built in the heart of Shoeville, which attracted many visitors each year. This museum was set up by Prime Minister Goodfellow and his advisers with help from Daisy, Bert, Martha and Roderick, because nobody wanted the people of Cornucopia to forget the years when the country believed all Spittleworth's lies. Visitors to the museum could view Major Beamish's silver medal, with Flapoon's bullet still buried in it, and the statue of Nobby Buttons, which had been replaced in Shoeville's biggest square, with a statue of that brave Ickerbog who walked out of the marshlands carrying a bunch of snowdrops, and in doing so saved both its species and the country. Visitors could also see the model Ickerbog that Spittleworth had made out of a bull's skeleton and some nails, and the huge portrait of King Fred fighting a dragonish Ickerbog that never existed outside the artist's imagination. But there's one creature I haven't yet mentioned. The first-born Ickerboggle, the savage creature who killed Lord Flapoon and who was last seen being dragged away by many strong men. Well, in truth, this creature was something of a problem. Daisy had explained to everyone that the savage Ickerboggle must not be attacked or mistreated, or it would hate people more than it already did. This would mean that at its bonding, it would bring forth Ickerboggles even more savage than itself, and Cornucopia could end up with the problem Spittleworth had pretended it had. At first, this Ickerboggle needed to be kept in a reinforced cage to stop it killing people, and volunteers to take it mushrooms were hard to find because it was so dangerous. The only people this Ickerboggle even slightly liked were Bert and Roderick,
because at the moment of its bonding, they'd been trying to protect its ichor. The trouble was, of course, that Bert was away in the army and Roderick was running a sheep farm, and neither of them had time to sit all day with a savage ichorboggle to keep it calm. A solution to the problem arrived at last from a very unexpected place. All this time, Fred had been crying his eyes out down in the dungeons. Selfish, vain, and cowardly though he had definitely been, Fred hadn't meant to hurt anyone, though of course he had, and very badly too. For a whole year after he'd lost the throne, Fred was sunk into darkest despair, and while part of the reason was undoubtedly that he now lived in a dungeon rather than in a palace, he was also deeply ashamed. He could see what a terrible king he'd been and how badly he had behaved, and he wished more than anything to be a better man. So one day, to the astonishment of Spittleworth, who was sitting brooding in the cell opposite, Fred told the prison guard that he'd like to volunteer to be the one to look after the savage Ichabod. And that's what he did. Though deathly white and trembly-kneed on the first morning, and for many mornings afterwards, the ex-king went into the savage Ichabod's cage and talked to it about cornucopia, and about the terrible mistakes he'd made, and how you could learn to be a better, kinder person if you really wanted to become one. Even though Fred had to return to his own cell every evening, he requested that the Ichabod be put into a nice field instead of a cage, and, to everyone's surprise, this worked well, and the Ichabod even thanked Fred in a gruff voice the following morning. Slowly, over the months and years that followed, Fred became braver and the Ichabod gentler. And at last, when Fred was quite an old man, the Ichabod's bonding came, and the Ichaboggles that stepped out of it were kind and gentle. Fred, who'd mourned their ichor as though it had been his brother, died very shortly afterwards. While there were no statues raised to their last king in any cornucopian city, occasionally people laid flowers on his grave, and he would have been glad to know it. Whether people were really bonded from Ichabogs, I cannot tell you. Perhaps we go through a kind of bonding when we change, for better or for worse. All I know is that countries, like Ichabogs, can be made gentle by kindness, which is why the kingdom of Cornucopia lived happily ever after. The Ichabod by J.K. Rowling was read by Stephen Fry. Text copyright 2020, J.K. Rowling. Sound recording copyright 2020, J.K. Rowling.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.